Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage. That's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on Plowman's Folly right after this. You know, we Americans talk a lot about private business. And we use terms like private ownership and private property and private rights. But we also use terms like stocks, bonds, negotiable instruments, licenses, and permits in our pursuit of profit and gain in our business transactions. Well, listen to this. Did you know that stocks and negotiable instruments are the exact opposite to private ownership? Bonds are the exact opposite to private property. Business licenses are the exact opposite to private rights. And permits are the exact opposite to private business. And why is it that we see small business being subjected to such a constant barrage of attacks by government at every level, from Washington to your hometown? And what can you do to protect your life, your liberty, and your property from these incessant attacks by OSHA, the EPA, the State Tax Commission, Zoning and Planning, the IRS, and the swarms of government agents and agencies who are eating out your substance? Well, you know, there's a lot that we can do. And the first step is to inform ourselves as to the legal alternatives that we have between public business and private business. Now, if you'd like to learn more about private business, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package and let me tell you more about what it is that you're not supposed to know about in private business. Remember, it's educational, entertaining, informative, and best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call and order yours right now. The area code is 417, and the number is 273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Again, that's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. Well, we've been talking about this thing of soil, Plowman's Folly. A guy by the name of Edward Faulkner back during World War II, an old-timey agronomist. His daddy was a farmer. And then he was a farmer. He went to ag school. He came out as an agricultural scientist. He's the only ag scientist that I know of that has written something as revolutionary. I mean, all these guys write pieces of paper, and Solomon said that, you know, of the writing of books, there's no end. This guy actually had something intelligent to say. And he questioned the very premise of agricultural science. He said, why are you people plowing? Because plowing has the exact opposite effect of what you want to do. You want to make the soil in a better condition so that the plants will grow and thrive in that soil better. Come to find out, plowing, it does just exactly the opposite. And it causes the loss of the organic material in the soil nutrients, at the rate of 7 to 1. That's right. For every ton of soil nutrients that you harvest, erosion takes 6 away. 6 away. You lose 6. Now, soil doesn't erode. Boys and girls, soil doesn't erode. Listen to this. In a very important sense, soil doesn't erode because the more or less pure minerals that are left after all the organic material or matter has disappeared from the land are not, properly speaking, soil at all. They are merely the raw materials from which soil was originally made and from which it can be made again. Erosion begins only after the soil surface has become virtually non-absorbent. That's a condition which has been induced by the compactness resulting from the loss of the highly absorbent cellular organic matter present in nearly all undisturbed soils. In native meadow or forest, rainfall, even the most torrential rain, strikes the spongy mass of humus and is held in place with little or no runoff. Wherever there is runoff, the movement is retarded, and it is ultimately halted by the successive areas of absorbent organic matter over which the water moves. In a tight soil, which is free from organic matter, erosion is almost inescapable because the very thinness of the soil defeats the gravitational movement of the water. Equally, a soil surface nicely charged with organic matter, decayed vegetable growth, trash, and dead and still living roots of all kinds, is poor field for the forces of wind erosion, which have been so destructive in certain western states of the United States. But a soil which has been impoverished of organic matter is all too often gone with the wind. Human generations are too short for us to have actually witnessed the complete cycle from virgin soil to eroded soil. William Byrd, the Virginia landsman of the 18th century, described the portion of his cycle, or this cycle, that most people today have never seen. The following account of corn planting by a farmer of the early days is quoted from Ben Ames. The story was called Come Spring. Ben Ames Williams is the guy's name. He said, he early cleared a patch of land and planted corn as soon as he had done his burning. The green wood was not consumed by the fire. The charred carcasses of trees lay everywhere. But he did his planting among all of these charred trees, poking a hole in the ground with a sharpened stick, dropping in two or three kernels, brushing earth into the hole with his foot. By great good fortune, I have witnessed the planting of a number of fields of corn in our own time by much the same method as that given above. Prodigious crops can be produced by such apparently careless methods in such an environment. 250 bushels to the acre are easily possible. Farmer's Bulletin number 400, issued by the United States Department of Agriculture, but now long out of print, describes a corn yield in South Carolina that measured 239 bushels to the acre, and it's certain that even this yield is well within present possibility. I think the average I just saw the other day, boys and girls, was 138 bushels on irrigated, hybridized corn fertilized with chemical fertilizers. On dry land patches, it runs around 60 bushels. Have we ever thought about land Sabbaths, virgin soil, and 250 bushels without any irrigation and without any fertilizer inputs? I'm not so sure, but what God's methodology isn't better. I mean, we haven't tested it or tried it in 200 years, but I just thought I'd throw that up for your consideration. Now, such highly productive land did not erode, and that's because it couldn't erode. There was no clean, smooth surface such as we now know. The entire depth of soil, perhaps 10 to 15 inches of it, was filled with visible organic fragments or was stained with the fine black smudge which represents the final stages of organic decay in the soil. This material is highly absorbent, at least to the last black stain. Now, such substances would scarcely permit a single drop of an ordinary rain to escape over the surface. There was too much empty space to be filled within the organic matter itself. Indeed, little water drained down through this material until it had taken all it could hold. The depth of the black zone and the amount of water that it already held determined how much additional water could be absorbed. In periods of very heavy rainfall, most of the water would go on through this massive course. There could be no runoff water except in long extended wet periods. Even then, the runoff water would not be stained with clay. It would be as clear as crystal. Very different from anything we see today going down the muddy Mississippi. The surface drainage from cultivated lands in our time is always the color of the land. Mud. And it'll perhaps be objected that when this mass becomes frozen solid, no more water can get into it than can penetrate any other solid mass. Well, that's true, if the mass becomes frozen solid, but it's difficult to freeze such a mass solid enough that water cannot penetrate it. There are two very good reasons for this. First, the water retained by fragments of organic matter is held within the fragments, leaving open spaces between them. Just examine a saturated pile of straw. There's no water between the straws, even though the straws themselves will be full and wet. Even when this water is frozen, there still is plenty of open space through the biomass. And such a mass of organic matter is so perishable that decay processes are continually in progress, except when there's too little heat or too little moisture. Now, to some extent, these fermentation processes provide their own necessary heat. Remember, in this connection, the gardeners depend upon the heat of fermenting manure to keep up the temperature of their hotbeds, and this ability to maintain higher temperatures, even in wintertime, shortens the period during which a highly organic soil can be frozen. Now, there are other influences that conspire to prevent tight freezing of a soil that is chiefly organic matter. A covering of snow is the best kind of insulation against the much colder upper air. Soil will often remain unfrozen through a long cold winter in temperate latitudes, provided, of course, that it's covered by enough snow. And it is well known that snow falling on weeds or any other kind of organic matter is more apt to remain snow than it would if it fell on moist, unfrozen mineral earth or soil or sand. When snow falls on the latter, it immediately dissolves, much as it would if it fell into the water. Yet at the same time, that which falls on grass, boards, rail fences, roofs, or any other dry substance may accumulate rapidly and remain undissolved. Soil which is highly organic in character, similarly, accumulates snow more readily because it always presents a drier surface. And it's reasonable to believe that throughout the winter it retains a thicker blanket of snow than the pure mineral earth or soil. And when the coming of spring, the heat of the fermentation within the soil will more quickly thaw out any frozen layer that might exist near the surface. And this improves internal conditions for water penetration. Now, it's long been known that relatively very little water escapes from a forest floor's runoff. Now, just why this is true has been a matter for conjecture. Though part of the explanation, at least, was advanced earlier in this chapter. A commonly held theory is that the organic matter hinders the progress of the water over the surface of the minerals in the soil, thus allowing more time for the minerals to soak it in. Doubtless, there is some such effect, and it may be more important than we think. It certainly is true that much of the water soaks directly into the leaves and other trash which are found on the ground. And we know that the entry of moisture into leaf tissue is much easier than into mineral soil. It may not be generally known that when water penetrates mineral masses, it does so by finding its way between the particles. The tiny particles of clay, silt, or sand are almost completely exclusive. Water cannot enter them. It can only cling to their outer surfaces. This is extremely important information to keep in mind in a study of soils, because organic matter, by contrast, literally pulls liquids into itself. Volume for volume, then, organic matter can hold many times as much water as can any kind of soil mineral. For organic matter is chiefly open space internally, while minerals are dense, solid crystals. A fateful distinction where water relations are concerned. Now, the idea is abroad that man is the lord of creation and that he dominates the earth. In certain minor respects, this may be true, but in the main, it's the purest propaganda, as ineffectual when we examine the facts, as whistling in the dark. Now, consider the single example of erosion. The alarm of thinking men today when they consider the plight of coming generations starving on eroded soil. It borders on panic. But what would they think if there were immediate prospects of a renewal of the worldwide erosion which originally sculpted the present features of the Earth's surface? That was erosion with a vengeance. Now, millions on millions of years of it. Mountains were buried in the sea by the tearing down of the original fire-formed stone of which they were composed, and the removal of the debris by the unhindered waters and winds which shuttled back and forth across such continents as it then existed. Geologists still puzzle over the wreckage, trying to piece out the story. Sky Faulkner was an evolutionist, wasn't he? If we take a look at agronomy from the perspective of the Mosaic Law, it becomes a whole lot clearer and a whole lot more logical. Now, you'll notice that Faulkner pointed out land Sabbaths. Sure, the Southerners, when they wore out a piece of ground, they would abandon it. And then it would come back several years later after it had been growing weeds and briars and brambles. They'd burn it off. They go in there and farm it up again, and it was renewed. Well, of course it was renewed. It was renewed by the decomposing briars and brambles and weeds. So don't think that briars, brambles, and weeds growing out there on a piece of clay soil, which is really poor earth, poor ground, is going to waste. You see, when that dandelion or thistle grows up, it dies, and when it dies, it decomposes. It creates organic material. It's a process that was designed by God, and there had to be organic material because organic material doesn't come out of mineral. It is true that plants need pure mineral, but no plant can live without organic material. And if there is any such plant, I don't know what it is. But I can take a look out here in the forest, and I can see a cedar tree growing on what appears to be solid rock. But when you take a look at it, there's some thin soil on top of that solid rock. Thin soil that contains the bodies, the dead organic material from times past. You go out here under a cedar tree, and you start digging around, and you'll see the cedar needles on top of the ground. Underneath it, you see the leaves and decaying material from last year, and then a little deeper down, it gets black, and a little deeper down, you come into the rock. Oak trees don't grow in those locations because the soil is too thin. So over time, various plants, thistles, weeds, cedar trees can grow on rock, mineral earth, and then they die, and their wood mass deteriorates, and it rots into organic material mixed with that mineral material, and it makes soil which is strong enough to support an oak tree, and so on up the life, so on up the line. You can't plant a carrot in solid rock. But lichen and moss will live right on the solid rock, and they decompose that mineral rock and turn it into organic material called lichen and moss, which in turn then is consumed by the brush, which in turn then dies, goes into the ground and is consumed by the trees, which in turn dies and goes back into the ground and is consumed by the grasslands and then the valleys and then and pretty soon somebody gets enough soil together that they can plant a carrot in and the man eats it. This is like a food chain. Now, admittedly, we have serious erosion to contend with. Much of our land is again in almost precisely the condition that all land was in before plants arrived. It's bare and it's in movement. And yet the present situation is immeasurably more favorable than the earlier one. The same destructive forces of wind and water are at work now as then. But the forces of plant opposition are now fully organized and mobilized. Alone, unless interfered with by man, plants can reclaim wayward land in an infinitesimal fraction of the time that was required eons ago before they had adapted themselves to such work. Or wouldn't it make more sense before they were created for such work? Even so, such a reclamation period, when measured in terms of human lifetimes, may be excessively long, and we're likely to get hungry waiting for natural forces alone to stop erosion and restore soil to the eroding mineral surface. Men must lend a helping hand. Somebody said the other day that we were looking for life out in outer space. Hell, I don't think we found intelligent life here on planet Earth yet. You mean to tell me that dumb, inanimate, random chance can produce the soil and the 186,000 organisms per cubic foot to turn this into virgin soil that grows corn 16 feet tall? And intelligent men cannot observe and then replicate the process? And you call that intelligence? I call that degeneration. I call that stupidity. I'm chief among them. I mean, I was out there with my moldboard plow, plowing and destroying the land just as fast as I could, but I never claimed that I had any intelligence. Now along comes Faulkner, and he says, now listen, let's observe the forest, let's observe the fence rows, and let's see if we can't emulate that. He tested it. Worked like a shot. So we go out here in the field, and we try to practice agriculture. Actually, today we call it agribusiness. Agribusiness. And we get some guys, you know, they're born in New York or Chicago, in the city. And then they go to college. They come out of college and they're called scientists. And these scientists then go to work for Monsanto. Monsanto pays them money and they come up with these neat ideas like GMOs and chemical fertilizers and so on. They go out and they sell that to these farmers over here who are dumb and ignorant and never went to college and don't have any smarts. And that's the process that the Bible calls the blind leading the blind, and they both fall in the ditch. The processes by which vegetation accomplishes a new cover where the previous cover has been destroyed are neither secret nor are they mysterious. All botany texts and a variety of other scientific treatises discuss the influences that determine the development of plant communities. These factors have been so ably discussed elsewhere, there's no necessity for me to do so here. But it may be pertinent, however, to introduce some of the underlying principles which determine the nature of plant successions as they occur. Important among the life factors that occasion the growth of one plant as against another is a given location where the requirements of the species for water and for heat, although the temperature of the air is influenced to a certain extent by the soil, we can pass over because it's not a major concern. Water being literally managed by the surface upon which it falls becomes the key factor to be discussed. Moreover, the manner in which the supply of water available for future plants is increased or decreased from year to year as a result of changes wrought by successive generations of plants on that site is an important consideration for all of us. Now, the earliest plants to occupy an area are composed of a more or less spongy tissue capable of absorbing and holding water for future needs. In addition to that being used currently, this reserve of water is supplied to the active plant tissues as required, and it saves the plant from extinction when its roots have exhausted the supply of water in the soil. Such are the lichens and mosses. Their remains, unless whisked away by the wind, accumulate from year to year. In a few years, the soil itself will necessarily have become intermixed with these spongy remains of mosses and lichens, so that many times more water will be retained in the soil than could be held by the pure minerals in the beginning. This additional water makes the living lichens thrive, which in turn further increase year by year the accumulated sponginess in the soil itself. If there were no other kinds of plants in the world, it is easy to conjecture that these pioneer plants might develop into giant sizes, like the cactus of the desert. Now, miles away from this hypothetical spot, where the lichen moss drama has attracted a better water supply, another spot is covered by plants that could not possibly have endured the conditions through which lichens and mosses have lived and prospered. As if by magic, seeds of these less hardy plants arrive by wind, bird, or animal. Presently, the new plants annihilate the pioneers by the simple procedure of growing taller and robbing them of their essential sunshine. So the plants that prepared the way for these interlopers have to find another bare spot on which to make a new start. Later, the newcomers, in their turn, are driven away by another kind, even less hardy, for which they have paved the way. In this evolution of plant populations on a given spot, the indispensable condition to a thriving community is increasing ability of the soil to retain its rainfall. Now, the availability of water, while a prime consideration, is no more important than other requirements of plant growth, but it may prove the key factor in determining the degree to which a given species is provided with or exposed to other needed conditions. Thus, water availability, by developing more expansive tissues, necessarily creates light limitations for low-growing plants, so that water, not the unavailability of light, becomes the primary factor in crowding out a species which fails because of a lack of light. It would not be surprising to find that the presence or absence of water is the real key to situations supposedly created by other factors. But in any case, each successive stage in the laying down of an absorbent mat on the Earth's surface removes one step further the possibility of runoff and erosion. It's not for nothing that writers have referred in literary contexts to the Earth's carpet, for in a very special sense, it is the carpet which covers and protects the landscape. So consider the fallen autumn leaves. Snow will billow high upon them in the winter months, then melt in the sunshine of spring, and yet the leaves in the center of a heap will be dry, and it's this humus below which has profited as the winter moisture has filtered slowly down to be caught and held by the sponge of true earth. Now, conventional thinking about erosion so far has centered about the idea of securing greater infiltration into the mineral soil, since that's about all that is left on many farms. Today, when we grow things outside of organic soil, we call it hydroponics. Hydroponic farming is about the equivalent of bottle feeding a baby. You see, good organic soil has 186,000 little microbes and little animals and little creatures in there that are all eating the cellulose and breaking it down and making nutrients available to the plant roots of the new generation of plants. And in the process of doing that, it produces healthy, nutritive products like corn and soybeans and cotton. Now, when you contrast that when you farm that soil, when you poison that soil with chemicals and sprays, and you destroy all of those 186,000 little organisms in there, or the majority of those little organisms, what you have then is just sand, just mineral dirt, mineral earth. So that this mineral earth then won't grow the kinds of plants with the health and with the vitality and with the nutrients in it that the organic soil, the virgin soil, the healthy soil will grow. And because of that lack of growth on that soil, then we have to do something. So we put chemical fertilizers on, hybridize seed, and then we grow lush crops of foodless foods that we feed to our people here in the United States. Now, conventional thinking about erosion so far has centered on the idea of securing greater infiltration into the mineral soil, since about that is about all that's left on many farms. We have given almost no thought to the idea of providing volumetric space in and on top of the soil into which the rainfall would be helplessly snatched as soon as it fell, like rain falling on a sponge, thus halting erosion at its source. Two reasons have been fostered and favored in such thinking. First, it's never been thought possible for planting and cultivation to be done except on a smooth surface. Hence, nobody thought to try or suggest the possibility of growing cultivated crops without first disposing of whatever trash littered the surface. Such trash was always disposed of by plowing or by fire. Now, I went up to Vanderhoof, British Columbia many years ago, and I bought a half a section of land up there. It had some prairies in it, pretty good piece of ground, I thought. Now, it has 127 frost-free days. It's called the Banana Belt of British Columbia. 127 frost-free days. The people there make their living by cutting the timber off of it for the pulp mills. That's where they make their cash. And then they burn all of the trash. Then they dig out the roots and farm it up. And the farmland lasts in growing grain for about 15 years. 15 years. And then it becomes unfertile and unusable. Well, that's exactly what Faulkner is describing here. The organic material in forest land is in the trees. And when you cut the trees off, you are taking your organic material and you're selling it. What's left is being burned, therefore it's being destroyed. What little bit of organic material is down there in the soil came from the needles over a period of time that have fallen on the ground and rotted. So we come in and disturb the soil, open it up to the elements, and then the rain and the melting snow leach out this organic material, and it floats down the Fraser River and out into the Pacific Ocean, leaving precious little real organic material left in the soil until we farm it out and ship it off, and then we wake up one day and it doesn't even grow wheat. Slash and burn. That's what we call that. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly and has a radio log schedule and archives that can be accessed through the website. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. In addition, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. If you'd like to order yours or order one for yourself, please call the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. The sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. So while we get to that paragraph, let me suggest that you get a copy of Plowman's Folly, Edward H. Faulkner, local used bookstore. F-A-U-L-K-N-E-R is the way you spell his last name. Plowman's Folly, published by the University of Oklahoma Press in Norman, Oklahoma, back in 1943. It's an old, old textbook from the agricultural school that I attended in Eureka, California. And I think you can probably get a copy for 10 or 15 bucks. I think that's what I've paid for the two or three that I've bought over the years. Now, the endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are going to reciprocate, and that's because most of these authors and publications cited on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or of this local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we are reviewing a book called Plowman's Folly as it relates to this thing of plowing. We're talking about the organic material in the soil. Soil, good, healthy soil, virgin soil, forest soil, prairie soil doesn't erode. What's eroding is the farm soils, the soils that we plow, the soils that we farm, the soils that we leave open to the elements, and we never let rest and never practice a land Sabbath on. Those are the soils that are eroding. And what's eroding out of those soils is the organic mass and material. Now, just looking out here where I live in the Ozarks, in 1880, there was 2 feet of soil on top of this ground where I live. 2 feet, 24 inches. That's 2 feet. Today, I don't think you could find an inch. Oh, maybe if you go out underneath a cedar tree, you can get an inch of topsoil. All that's left is the clay, the underlying clays and rock. By 1940, it was a moonscape. What they did was they came in and clear-cut these forests for railroad and bridge timbers, railroad ties and bridge timbers. And they built railroads, you know, from 1880, 90, 1900, 1910, 1920, through the 30s. And then by 1940, they'd cut it all off. Then the rains poured down. It rains 50 inches a year here. And there's nothing to hold it. It's all been torn up. The soil's all loose from the logging operations. And so it washes down into the valleys and down the creeks and down the rivers. And it ends up, you guys down there in New Orleans have it all. 40,000 square miles of real estate, 2 feet deep with topsoil, and it's, for practical purposes, virtually all washed off and now sits south of New Orleans in what they call the Delta, the Mississippi River Delta. That's what happened to our topsoil. Now, fortunately, the trees are growing back, and, you know, given enough time, it takes 90 years to produce an inch of topsoil. And so we actually have about an inch of topsoil here, especially out here under the trees. We have about an inch, and it hasn't been 90 years. So it's building up nicely. And in about 1,000 years, we'll have a foot of topsoil. In about 2,000 years, we'll have 2 feet of topsoil. We'll be right back to where we were in 1880. Man is a rapacious critter, isn't he? Destroys just about everything he gets his hands on. And then we give him nuclear weapons, and somehow or another we think he can handle nuclear weapons. He can't even handle the dirt under his feet. What would make us think that men are smart enough to handle nuclear weapons, nuclear energy, when they're not smart enough to manage dirt? And we call that intelligence? Doesn't strike me as being very intelligent. Now, it's never been thought possible for planting and cultivation to be done except on a smooth surface. So nobody ever thought or suggested the possibility of growing cultivated crops without first disposing of whatever trash littered the surface. Such trash was always disposed of by plowing. Farmers and scientists have long known that the chief need of soils is for organic matter, organic material. But that need was supposed to be met by plowing the organic matter into the soil to a depth of 6 to 8 inches. Nobody seemed to realize that this procedure actually robbed the following crop of virtually all of the substance of this buried organic matter. By such hapless reasoning, we have preserved for generations a system of soil management which should long ago have been revised to conform to the known facts. Planting can be done in a trashy surface. It had to be done so when the land was first cleared. Doubtless it is easier to manage land which has nothing on the surface to be caught and dragged along by the sliding equipment that we use for planting and cultivating. But if the crop planted in such smooth land was necessarily, or must necessarily, produce a smaller yield because of the purity of the minerals, freedom from decaying organic matter. So we work hard to produce soils that have no organic material so that the plants have virtually no food. That's why I call that hydroponics. Now it works. It works. See, you can just feed plants in a sand medium, and you can just feed them nutrients that are supplied in the water that you put on the plants. Yeah, you can do that. It's called hydroponics. And those plants will grow up to be nutritionally deficient, whether they're grown out here on the land or they're grown in a greenhouse or a hothouse, because you can't get any more nutrients into the plant that is in the nutrient solution that you're feeding them. We do that with feeding babies or feeding calves. See, you take mother's milk now. It has 107 known substances in it. It's got vitamins and minerals, and it's got amino acids and all this stuff, you know. 107. There's more. We haven't identified them all yet. We haven't hung labels on them yet. Now, you go down here and buy some Similac down at the Circle K store, and you take that home, and they proudly pronounce that it has 12 essential vitamins and minerals. Let's see. If I get my trusty Sharp EL1197G3 Texas Instruments calculator out, and I plug in 107, and then we take away from that 12. Leaves us with 95. So you go down here and you raise this baby on these 12 essential vitamins and minerals, and you starve this kid of the 95 of the other essential vitamins and minerals and acids and all this other stuff that's in here and some stuff that we don't even know about. And we wonder why our children are growing up to be weak and anemic, sick, undernourished runts. I go to the city every once in a while and I watch these freaks walking around in Battlefield Mall. You can't believe. Some of them are so fat they can hardly waddle. Some of them are skinny as rails. They're so skinny and undernourished, they're anorexic. And others are misshapen. And all of them have been raised on this Similac, for crying out loud, instead of feeding them something that's good. We do the same thing with our plants, you know. We feed these plants with these chemical fertilizers. And they look real good, you know. But then when you test them, you know, they're sick, weak, undernourished, non-performing runts. And I just put that out for your consideration. I don't want you to give up Similac and Infamil and feed your baby's breast milk, for crying out loud, ladies. It might do something to you. I don't know what, but it, you know, might do something. But then don't wonder why this kid turns out to be sick and you got him in the doctor's office, you know, twice a month, and you're spending buku bucks on this kid because he's always got an ear, throat, or nose problem. How could he have anything else? He's starving to death. Well, it seems logical to suggest the wisdom of trying to devise implements which will negotiate the trashy surface. Equally, if crop yield is greater from a trashy surface, as has been proved by official tests at the Nebraska Experiment Station, the desirability of the necessary equipment is beyond question. I think what you probably need, hang on a second. I don't know. Seems like I got a lot of static here. There, that helps a little bit. You think you're going to go to John Deere and get them to make some kind of new equipment? You think you're going to get the people over at OrthoGrow or DuPont to come out here and say, hey, we need to straighten out this soil over here so that you can farm it with a crooked stick and produce as much as an Egyptian farmer per acre, so that you can get plants that produce 250 bushels of corn to the acre and grow 16 feet tall? You're not going to get that, not in America, not out of Monsanto, DuPont, Standard Oil, and John Deere. You know, these boys know where the money's at, and nobody gives a rat's ass about your health. Nobody's concerned about the nutritional value of the foods that are being sold over here at Kroger's and Safeway. And for that matter, only 12% of the people in America are into health foods anyway. Only 12% of the people in America, again, let me get my sharp EL1197G3 Texas Instrument calculator out here. And we've got 300 times, that's 300 million people, times 0.12. About 36 million people in the country out of 300 million are concerned about the food that they eat and their health. The other 88% couldn't care less, probably prefer GMOs and chemically grown food, probably. Now, for the 12% of us, that 36 million people that are concerned about it, may I suggest that you inform yourself by reading the book called Plowman's Folly. I can't cover everything in the book, but I can give you the highlights and I can tell you what the bottom line is. I can do that much. I've said in the past, there's nothing in a modern American supermarket fit for human consumption. And if there is something in there, it is so well concealed that I haven't been able to find it. So if you know of anything that's in there, send me an email, let me know. Would you? And I might go buy some of it. I saw the other day Walmart said that they were going to try to put more organic foods on their shelves. That's a step in the right direction. I don't deny it. But these organic foods that these people are putting on your shelves are grown with hybridized seed. And there's no guarantee that these organic products aren't GMO or GMO tainted, because the organic business is being taken over by the old established food manufacturing companies like General Mills, Pillsbury, and Kraft Foods, Heinz, and so on. So they've already been to the legislature and they've already gotten legislation passed. And so they're starting to water down organic already. See, if the product has 5% inorganic and 95% organic, that's okay. Well, next thing, they'll say, well, if it's got 90% organic and 10% inorganic, well, then that'll be a new law passed, and then it'll be 80% and 70%. Kind of reminds me of the Subi honey. You go into the grocery store, and here's this beautiful bottle of pure. They write the word pure, P-U-R-E, pure Subi honey. Tuck it away in your heart. And so the honey people, they went to the legislature and they got this law passed. And so here's what's in that jar, though. It's got 51% honey and 49% corn syrup. And the label says pure Subi honey. They're not lying to you. They're not lying to you. The 51% of the honey that's in the jar is pure honey. They just don't tell you about the 49% of the corn syrup that's in there, because the law says if it contains 51% honey, you don't have to tell anybody what else is in the jar. We presume that it's pure. They do the same thing with milk. Milk. See, they put additives in that milk. They don't tell you what those additives are. They don't want you to know. And so we have people in America that are lactose intolerant. These are people that cannot drink milk. They drink milk and they get sick. They get allergies. God gave us the land of milk and honey, but it wasn't pasteurized. God gave us honey, but it wasn't pasteurized. These guys today, they heat that honey up until it flows like water. Yeah, how honey pours out so slow, and yet, God, that stuff is thick. Just heat it up to about 200 degrees. And it'll run like water. And you can filter all the nutrients right out of it. Well, anything that's fit for human consumption, you can filter out. And then you can stick that in a jar. It'll never sugar. By the way, I'll pass this on to you. When you buy honey, you should buy honey that's already sugared. That is, it got hard. Sugared's what they call that. If honey always stays in its liquid form and it doesn't sugar, it's been heated above 132 degrees and it doesn't have the enzymes left in it. The enzymes are all dead. That's what causes it to sugar. See? Now, honey will keep forever. It's so dense, it's got so much sugar in it that it'll keep. The bacteria doesn't get in there and spoil it. But if you eat that stuff without the natural enzymes that is in it, like the enzymes in milk. See, you have to have the milk enzyme to digest it. You've got enzymes in your gut, but it won't digest the milk. And it won't digest the honey either. Now, how's that? So you can't eat honey that's been heated, and you can't drink milk that's been heated and maintain your health. So if you're a big milk drinker and you're drinking your milk out of Safeway and Kroger, that's deadly poison. That's going to kill you. You're not going to last long doing that. That'll give you atherosclerosis. No wonder we have such a high incidence of cardiovascular disease in the United States. We have the highest incidence of heart attack and stroke in the world. We're also the consumers of the highest quantities of saturated fats. Just thought I'd pass that on to you for what it's worth. Now, you know, we emerge with two highly important objectives well within our grasp. Improved crop yield, which is immediate, and arrested soil erosion, which is long range but closely related to our ultimate welfare. Both are attainable by the simple procedure of abandoning the ancient practice of plowing organic matter under and substituting instead the effective practice of leaving the matter on the surface or working it in from the top. This organic sponge on top precludes erosion and provides the substance for maximum plant growth. That which has been plowed under leaves a denuded and tight surface, ideally suited to the processes of erosion, while the nutriment for plants lies 6 to 8 inches below their incipient roots, out of reach, and therefore ineffectual for the principal purposes at hand. I might point this out. You can go test it for yourself. Just go out here under your, on your lawn under a tree, and start digging around in the surface, and you'll see in the top 2 inches is where all of the feeder roots are located. That's why you want all this trash on top of the ground. You know, you go out into the forest, there's nobody out there raking up the leaves and burning them. Human beings, for some reason, like to be neat and tidy, but that isn't conducive to plant growth. Out in the forest, the tree falls down and it lays on the ground, the branches and limbs fall down, and it catches all the water, catches all the moisture, catches all the snow. You don't see any erosion going on out here under your trees. It's when you log the trees off. It's when you clear cut. It's when you disturb the soil and everything washes off. That's where erosion is located. And of course, the logger says, well, I have to do it that way to make money. No, you don't. No, you don't. Farmer says, well, I got to do it that way to make money. No, you don't. Not true. Not true at all. We do it that way because we can make more money, because it has less work, and we don't have to be responsible for the damages that we do in future generations. I mean, the people that came out here to Ozark County, clear-cut this, and took the bridge timbers and the railroad ties, they're all long dead. They came out and did their harvest and left us with the mess, left us with the worn-out, destroyed land. Left us with the soil washed down to the Mississippi Delta. They didn't care. Well, at some point in time, somebody has to take responsibility, so I'm one of them. So I'm taking responsibility, so I came into the game, and now I'm restoring the land. And I want to help the rest of you do the same thing. That's what we were instructed in the scripture. God told us to dress and keep the land. So I'm taking a look at the ground. I'm saying, oh my God, what a wreckage we've got here. And I have done over the past 20 years a tremendous amount of restoration. I can't build 2 feet of topsoil over 300 acres, you know, over the next 20 years. But over the next 1,000 years, we can. And I started right here. We've got an inch to work with, and let's build it up to 2 inches, and then 3 inches, and 4 inches, and let's stop destroying it. I know it's a wild new concept, but it can be done, and Faulkner shows the way. All right, we're about out of time. I got to leave it right there. We'll take it up here again tomorrow night. You've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. If you'd like more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, just go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. And if you're not online and you don't know how to do that, you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. How's that? Area code 417-273-4967. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All right, we're out of time. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course. Until then, thanks for listening. Good night, friends.